Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Every Monday night, we're live and local with news, conversation, and culture from this place we call home. Tonight, we dive into San Francisco mayors, past and present. First, we'll discuss current Mayor Daniel Lurie's new budget, which is widely viewed as his first major challenge. With the city facing huge deficits, does Lurie have, does his proposed budget do enough? Who are the winners and the losers? Then we'll talk to Lincoln A. Mitchell about his new book, 3 Years Our Mayor, George Moscone and the Making of Modern San Francisco. And finally, we'll hear about the itinerant life of the Sutro Library, a collection pulled together by former Mayor Adolph Sutro. But first, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. As protests continue against ICE arrests in Los Angeles tonight, the Trump administration now says it is mobilizing 700 Marines to the city. That's after the deployment of 2,000 National Guard troops and the just-announced deployment of 2,000 more. California's attorney general says the president has, quote, trampled on the state's sovereignty and filed a lawsuit. City streets were quieter today, though at the moment there's still tensions at another rally in the city's downtown. Multiple immigration raids in the Fashion District in downtown L.A. Friday led to the arrest of more than 40 workers, more than a dozen from one company. NPR's Vanessa Romo reports on a rally held by their family members.
At least a dozen of the 14 people taken away by ICE and FBI officers are in some way related or can trace their connections back to the same Zapotec town in Veracruz, Mexico. Sarai Ortiz says her dad, 55-year-old Jose Ortiz, has worked at Ambiance Apparel for 18 years as a floor manager. She says her father has been sharing Know Your Rights cards with fellow employees, encouraging them to be informed, not afraid. But now he's been gone for more than 2 days, and she still has no idea how or where he is. She tried the county jail, but they tell her he's not in the system. Vanessa Romo, NPR News.
The Trump administration's travel ban blocking or restricting entry from more than a dozen mainly African and Middle Eastern countries has gone into effect. Ban comes as tensions escalate over the administration's crackdown on illegal immigration. Here's NPR's Jasmine Garz.
It is a long list. 12 countries fully banned, including Haiti, Afghanistan, Iran, Yemen, Libya, Sudan, and Somalia. And citizens from 7 other countries will be subjected to partial bans, including Cuba, Sierra Leone, and Venezuela. Now, these are countries that the administration has deemed a threat to national security or public safety. And this ban builds on the ban from Trump's first term, which was upheld by the Supreme Court.
NPR's Jasmine Garz. A federal judge has temporarily blocked the Trump administration's Department of Government Efficiency team from accessing federal personnel records, NPR's Shannon Bond reports.
The court ruled the Federal Office of Personnel Management broke privacy law and its own cybersecurity practices when it allowed DOGE staffers to access the files of millions of current and former federal workers. The scope of the injunction is still being determined by the court. But Judge Denise Coate ordered DOGE staff to destroy all copies of personal information related to the union members who brought the lawsuit. The case will likely head to the Supreme Court, which has recently reversed other lower court rulings curtailing DOGE. Last week, the High Court granted DOGE access to sensitive data held by the Social Security Administration. Shannon Bond, NPR News.
A mixed close on Wall Street. The Dow was down a point. The Nasdaq rose 61 points. This is NPR.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. Tonight, we're focused on San Francisco mayors, past and present. Later on in the hour, we're going to be talking to Lincoln A. Mitchell about his new book, 3 Years Our Mayor, George Moscone and the Making of Modern San Francisco. And then we'll explore the itinerant life of the Sutro Library, a collection created by former Mayor Adolph Sutro. But first up, we're talking about the budget that Mayor Daniel Lurie recently released. It's Lurie's first major challenge during a tenure that, up until now, has been marked largely by good vibes. Lurie has proposed a $16 billion budget, but the city controller's office anticipates a deficit of $817 million for fiscal years 2025 to 2026, and nearly a $1 billion deficit for fiscal years 27 to 28. That is the largest expected deficit in the city's history. Here to help us make sense of all of this is Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, politics reporter at the San Francisco Standard. Welcome back to State of the Bay, Joe Fitz.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, Joe, every time we talk about the city's budget, we always hear from listeners, why is that budget $16 billion? So help us clear up some common misperceptions about the budget that so that we can dive into deeper.
Oh, yeah, sure. One of the biggest things is that San Francisco is both a city and a county. So it's more applicable as if you were to think of Oakland's budget paired up with Alameda County's budget, and probably even a little bigger than that. So there's a lot of federal and state dollars that pass through the county of San Francisco to uses like, you know, Medi-Cal, that kind of thing. That's money that the city doesn't have access to kind of mess around with. This is predetermined federal and state dollars. The actual amount of money that the mayor and the board of supervisors have to play around with, so to speak, is about $4 billion.
Mm. And when we look at the budget that Lurie has proposed, that $4 billion that he can, quote, play around with, what does the budget reveal about Lurie and his priorities?
You know, it's a lot of what he promised on the campaign trail. He promised law and order and kind of a safer city, safer, cleaner city, having to deal with homelessness and fentanyl. I'm not saying that this money will absolutely do that, but he's trying to. So the money is preserving SFPD, the sheriff's department, district attorney, public defender, whereas other departments are seeing cuts. And while we see cuts in the homelessness department's grant spending, some of that he's going to try to make up with private dollars.
Well, and when you say private dollars, we've heard in the past Lurie has been trying to raise money, and he's good at that, right? Because he was a CEO of Tipping Point, a nonprofit. And where is he trying to raise this money from, though?
Right. He's basically turning this into Tipping Point the government a little bit. he's trying to raise it from, you know, the wealthy folks that he raised money from for Tipping Point. And he's made organizations downtown kind of CEOs and other kind of wealthy individuals to try to channel and harness some of that money towards civic good. The question, though, is that replicable by future mayors? Could a mayor in the future, without the access of a Daniel Lurie, mm-hmm. former Tipping Point head, be able to raise those same dollars? Or would they have to then rely back on city coffers?
Mm. You were mentioning that, you know, issues like public safety and ethics, clean streets, those got a lot of attention from Lurie in this budget and a little bit of love with some financing. Tell me what areas are facing cuts? Like, who are the losers of this budget?
Certainly, you know, what you're really going to hear about this week and next week with a lot of protests and a lot of acrimony are nonprofits. Now, rewind in your the year back a year or two and remember all of the nonprofit scandals that have come out with the Dreamkeeper Initiative. That's an initiative to fund help in the Black community and other nonprofits. These are kind of like exceptions to the many hundreds of nonprofits that help the city provide services, but they received a lion's share of the attention, and politically they've kind of weakened nonprofits in general. So it's, you know, a cut that Lurie is able to make without too much acrimony from the public, but the nonprofits certainly are seeing a cut of, you know, hundreds of millions, about $200 million in the next budget. And that's affecting things over all sorts of services. That's everything from, you know, power washing in Chinatown to after school services and some rental assistance services. It's just about anything you can think of that someone goes to get help from, where the city makes a referral to an outside group and says, these guys will help you with this. They're facing cuts.
You know, is that normal for a municipality to rely so heavily on nonprofits, Joe, to get, I mean, the things that you were describing, like power washing the street, feels like that's, you know, a function of city government, not necessarily a nonprofit. Or is that very typical these days?
Well, you know, there are some things that the city of San Francisco has thought, we can't move nimbly on these things. We can't move fast. We can't set up and shut down. We can't shift our attention from one neighborhood to another as quickly with some things. So the power washing example, for instance, is not just power washing. It's a program to train recent Chinese immigrants in how to do power washing cleaning services. It's a workforce program so that they can then get jobs later. So there's a lot of workforce programs as well in one particular segment of the city's budget that are getting cut. These are like, you know, opportunities for some of the poorest people who might not have opportunities otherwise, who, you know, nonprofit leaders say, oh, they may, you know, turn to, there may be more crime if you don't give enough people opportunities. And those are also facing the chopping block. So there's a lot of programs that are meant to educate and help that are kind of services that the city has deemed in the past, we can't do this as well or as quickly or as cheaply. That's the other thing as nonprofits can, because they don't necessarily have union workers. They're not paying as well as the city would. And so we can give them less money than it would cost for the city to provide it. So it's even a cost saving measure.
Yeah. I mean, and is it possible that whatever service that nonprofit was providing won't be replaced by the city?
Oh, it's absolutely possible, because it's far more expensive for the city to provide many of these services. In some cases, the city will try to shore up what is being cut from the nonprofits. But for the most part, the whole reason that they go to the nonprofits in the first place is it's cheaper. Now, that effect is blunted a bit when, and your listeners may have seen the various diagrams of so many nonprofits. There's a lot. It's a dizzying Byzantine system that the city really hasn't wrapped its arms around. It's grown. It's grown and grown and grown. And folks haven't really gotten their arms around making sure there's not too much redundancy. And so that is a problem that Lurie's team has identified in the budget.
Well, let's talk about Lurie's relationship with labor. Employee compensation costs have risen at a faster rate than inflation. And in theory, Lurie might be a little less beholden to labor unions because he didn't win their support in his mayoral campaign. But is Lurie doing anything different with regard to labor with this budget?
Yeah, so this is what fascinated me. Lurie walks into city government with an amazing amount of political capital, a lot of goodwill at his back, a lot of people in San Francisco very glad to see him in office. He's got a lot of positivity. The polls all show it. He had a lot of political capital to spend. If there's any time to royally piss off the unions and make the harshest cuts, not that I'm saying he should, but if there's any time that he could, it would be now. And he said over and over again, I'm going to make structural cuts, structural cuts, structural cuts. But when it came down to it, when he finally announced his budget, it was fascinating. There was 1,400 job reductions, but most of those are vacancies. Only about 150 of those are true layoffs, at least as far as we can tell so far. And the unions are still furious, absolutely furious. Huge, biggest protests I've seen in a long time, just last week, to stop these layoffs. But if you're going to get the protests anyways, and if you have all that political goodwill, why did he go gun-shy about cutting jobs? I'm not saying, again, that he should, but it was curious that he didn't after signaling.
Well, and there's some city groups, the centrist groups like Neighbors for a Better San Francisco and Connect SF, who really thought he should have cut more like 4,000 city jobs, right?
Oh, absolutely. There are tons of voices and more moderate Democrats here in the city and maybe more fiscally conservative Democrats that were saying, and Republicans are saying, what the heck are you doing? This was your chance. And really, we've seen in the past with London Breed's budgets in prior years that when you stave off pain for the next year has an even bigger cut you're going to have to make.
Right.
And that's what she did with last year's budget. She kind of plugged all the holes with one-time funds, the budgetary equivalent of finding change under the couch and throwing that in instead of reducing your spending.
Well, Lurie is taking $40 million from reserves for this budget. I mean, once reserves are taken, reserves are gone. So does this current moment justify drawing from those reserves?
Well, it's interesting. The unique twist that he would say to that is that he's using those reserves for one-time costs, not for fixed repeating costs, which is the difference between how he's using it, how London used it. Mayor Breed used those one-time funds to pay operational annual costs that were recurring instead of making a structural change. He's using that $40 million to pay like a one-time thing that will go away next year. You won't need to use $40 million again for it. So that is a big difference. And they are stashing away $400 million, all the extra money that they're finding. Mm-hmm. They're making kind of like a piggy bank, a bank account to forestall against Trump's federal cuts, which are incredibly possible. And even FEMA right now is trying to claw back money they already gave us and might, you know, wipe out half or all of that reserve.
Yeah. So, yeah, talking about the federal funding, I mean, what's the magnitude of federal funding that could be lost? Are we talking tens of millions, hundreds of millions?
Billions.
Billions.
Lurie and his team have been assembling a list of dollars and what departments are most vulnerable. Other news organizations have assembled kind of similar lists. We have we published parts about this and who's vulnerable, especially the Department of Public Health is vulnerable. Homelessness is vulnerable from the FEMA money. And that amount of money is something we don't have enough money necessarily to plug those holes.
Well, you know, given that, you know, property taxes, corporate taxes are so much of what our budget is, and, you know, downtown property isn't what it used to be, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's such a balancing act, too, because if you reduce the taxes too much, then even if businesses bounce back, the city wouldn't be making any money. Mm-hmm. But if you, you know, if you tax too heavily, then those businesses may not come back. So it's a difficult thing to do. And they're trying something new with Proposition M from last year to try to get downtown moving again.
Well, before we let you go, what's the next step here? What are you looking out? What should we be looking out for next, Joe?
Oh, yeah. So this whole month, the Board of Supervisors is going through really long hearings with all of the departments where they're going to basically beg for some of their money to be restored. Say, Board, please negotiate with the mayor. And we'll see the board do exactly that. They're going to ask the mayor to restore some of the funding in the budget before they will give their stamp of approval, the first stamp of which is due July 1st.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Joe Fitzgerald Rodriguez, politics reporter from the San Francisco Standard.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Lincoln A. Stevens about his new book, 3 Years Our Mayor, George Moscone and the Making of Modern San Francisco. That's right after the break. Stay with us.
Each week, BayMade features one local independent podcast or producer. For Pride Week on KALW, we're sharing stories about queer culture, news, and history from Christopher Beale's podcast, Stereotypes. So tune into BayMade all week at 11:30 a.m. for Stories of Pride, right here on 91.7 FM, KALW, San Francisco, Bay Area.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11. Fans and players are feeling the rub at their interim ball field.
Fans and people watching from Oakland and the visitors are all coming to this ballpark ready to kind of hate on it. The bottom line is we know they're going to Vegas. We know this is a temporary kind of a deal out here.
An update on the A's troubled move to Las Vegas. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. The assassination of San Francisco Mayor George Moscone in 1979 is often eclipsed by that of Harvey Milk, who was also murdered that same day by fellow supervisor Dan White. Author Lincoln Mitchell argues that Moscone is due for a reevaluation. His new book is 3 Years Our Mayor, George Moscone and the Making of Modern San Francisco. And Mitchell is an adjunct associate professor of political science at Columbia University and splits his time between New York and San Francisco. Lincoln, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. And listeners, before we get started, we wanted you to be part of the next conversation about the legacy of George Moscone. He was more than just the namesake of the convention center. So do you have any memories of George Moscone? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can find us on social media or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Well, Lincoln, in the previous segment, we were talking about Daniel Lurie's budget, and I'm so curious about the through line from Moscone to where we are today. But first, I just wanted to remind people about who Moscone was. I mean, as I said in the introduction, he's become almost a footnote in the Harvey Milk story. But tell us a little bit about George Moscone, who he was and where he came from.
George Moscone was born and raised in San Francisco. He grew up in the Cow Hollow neighborhood at Filbert and Buchanan. He was raised by a single mother. And the reason I say that is because I also grew up in the Cow Hollow neighborhood and was raised by a single mother. He's a bit older than me, but we have that in common. He was Italian-American in what was then a pretty heavily Italian-American part of town. I am not, but everyone thought I was because it was still Italian-American enough when I was growing up. And I didn't say anything because the older Italian woman at the bakery is always giving me the cookies and stuff, so
hey,
I just let it
that's
go.
That makes sense to me. I mean, smart you.
That's exactly. So from a political perspective, the first thing we should know about Moscone is that he was legitimately a groundbreaking politician as a progressive. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. Just by way of background, he served 3 years in the Board of Supervisors, and then from 64 to 66, and from 67 to 75 was the state senator from San Francisco and the majority leader for the Democrats in the Senate, and then, of course, mayor for 3 years before he was assassinated in 78. As mayor, that 75 election, which was a very heated, very competitive election between, well, George Moscone, John Barbagallata, and Dianne Feinstein, who just missed the runoff. But this was the first election where anybody in the United States running for a major office really made a direct appeal to African-Americans on after civil rights for African-Americans and for gay people, saying the same thing. And this was somebody, as state senator, during that year, he passed through a law, pushed it through the Senate, and then, of course, went through the Assembly, and Governor Jerry Brown signed it into law, legalizing consensual sex between two people of the same gender, which until that time was illegal in the state of California. So I just give that as an example. But he was also a, you know, very, very, unlike our current mayor, very strongly backed by labor every time he ran for office, and really had a vision for San Francisco that was about taking power away from downtown, which was both a kind of geographical area, we all know downtown, but also an economic construct, the powerful economic forces that ran the city, and bringing it to the neighborhoods and diversifying city government. He was the first person to appoint commissioners and board members who reflected the demographics of San Francisco. He was the first person to appoint an out gay person to a high level commissioner, and he appointed, that was Harvey Milk, who he put on the Board of Permit Appeals. So that's a very quick background on who he was and why I think he's an important figure.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, certainly there's many, many things that he did. But I just wanted to go back to George Moscone as a person. I mean, you mentioned that he grew up in Cal Hollow. He had a single mother. He was Italian-American Catholic. And, you know, you talk about all these things that he did that were progressive. But when you look at his biography, I mean, here's a kid who went to St. Ignatius, which is a very prestigious, elite Catholic high school on the west side, wasn't at the west side of the town at the time, but is now, and yet managed to find these values, you know, embracing the entirety of the city. Is that because of the way he was raised, being with just a single mom, or was it the Catholic tradition?
That is the question I wrestle with throughout the book. And for those younger listeners, St. Ignatius at that time was where USF is now, right near there. So kind of around Stanion, around Balboa, and Zaturk, that kind of part of town. That is a very difficult question. You know, a lot of people I spoke to about this who knew him, I mean, I was 10 years old when Moscone was assassinated, so I didn't know him. You know, my mother voted for him, but that was about the closest I got to him.
Yeah, she told you that you were a Moscone house, right?
That's right, she did. She did, absolutely.
I read that in the book.
Yes. But a lot of people attribute it to him being a basketball player. George Moscone was an all-city basketball player. You know, back at a time, he graduated from high school in the late 40s, when high school sports mattered a lot in San Francisco. And there is that old cliche of when we meet each other, we ask, where did you go to high school? And then what I always add is then we judge each other. Mm. But, you know, I played baseball in every neighborhood in San Francisco. I should add, just because I want to be straightforward with your listeners, George Moscone was an all-city basketball player at St. Ignatius. I was the backup first baseman at University High School, so we're not quite in the same league athletically. But I had the experience of going to every neighborhood. And people who walked into those neighborhoods, teammates of mine as racists, they walked out as racists. So just playing ball doesn't answer the question.
Yeah.
I think the answer comes partially from his mother, who was a hardworking single mother at a time that was unusual. It came from very modest background. We think of St. Ignatius as a school for more affluent, but that time it was young men and boys. But Moscone was not one of those guys. He really did not come from money. And then, you know, one of the people I spoke to who knew George Moscone after high school went to the Navy and then graduated in Santa Rosa Junior College. And then he graduated from the University of the Pacific, which was then College of the Pacific. And then he went to Hastings for law school, and he needed to make money while in law school, so he got a job as a custodian. And I talked to a gentleman who had been a custodian alongside of him, who was African-American, Willie Brown. Some of your listeners may be
yes,
familiar with that name. And he said, you know, as early as the mid to late 1950s, he'd never met a white guy who was so genuinely committed to civil rights.
Hmm.
And that's really striking. In 64, as a brand new member of the Board of Supervisors, he went down, Moscone went down to Mississippi, along with Terry Francois, who was an African-American member of that board at that time, to register voters. While in the state Senate, he marched with Cesar Chavez for the United Farm Workers. So, you know, it's hard to know where any of us get their politics. I grew up in a Moscone house, so I just got a progressive the old-fashioned way. I inherited it. But it's that is the question that I wrestle with throughout the book. And I really leave it to the reader because I can't know the answer to that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you certainly, you know, reading the book, especially about Moscone's early days, I mean, they say that San Francisco politics is a bit clubby. Everybody seems to know everybody. And I mean, as you point out, it's like Willie Brown shows up as a law school classmate. And the Burton brothers, John and Phil, who our listeners may not know, but were huge power brokers, factored into Moscone's early political career. Tell us a little bit about the Burtons and how they helped Moscone along.
Well, I might say they factored into George Moscone's entire political
career. Yes, yeah.
And his first encounter was with John Burton, who was younger than Phil Burton. And John Burton, I interviewed John Burton, he was super helpful, but I think because this is a family radio program, I'm going to clean up some of the he speaks very colorfully, and I don't want to get either of us in trouble. But Burton indicated that there was a gap in stature, because Burton, when they met, was a freshman at Lincoln High School, and Moscone had just won the city championship at St. Ignatius, but they became friends, and John Burton respected that. They stayed friends through law school, and as I mentioned, Moscone was a big basketball player who throughout his life loved basketball. And while he was working as a young attorney after Hastings, he got a job as a playground attendant. Again, older San Franciscans may remember that. Burton was a playground attendant a couple playgrounds over. This was out in the Sunset District.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked John Burton, how does a guy get to be a judge? And he said, I don't know. Let me talk to my brother. And so they set up a meeting with Phil Burton, who at that time was in the Assembly and was looking at running for Congress, which he eventually did. And then he served for a long time in Congress. And Phil Burton peppered Moscone with political questions. Where do you stand on the death penalty? Moscone was against it. Where are you on loyalty oaths? He was against it, which was not a common position back then, although it was the right one, et cetera. And then Burton put him on a path, and he said, run for the Assembly in 1960, you'll lose. Next time something opens up on the board, you'll get in and you'll kind of be set. So it was a synergistic relationship. It was definitely a political operation. I wouldn't quite go as far as to call it a machine, but it was a very, very progressive one. And what the Burton saw in Moscone was that he could go places because he had a great San Francisco story.
Mm.
You know, single mom, Italian-American, good-looking guy, star basketball player, nice, attractive family, growing family, ended up having four children. Definitely, as one politician I interviewed said, he was a philanderer. And of course, a lot of older San Franciscans will probably want to talk about some of those stories. I try to leave the Peruvian element more or less out of the book, but it's true that he was. Burton saw Moscone as a guy who could go places, and they worked together. But throughout his career, every time he ran, he was attacked for being a tool of the Burtons.
Hmm.
It wasn't unequivocally positive for him, but it was something they were on the same page on the substance of the issues, and they definitely helped each other out.
Well, this is State of the Bay on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW Bay Area, and I'm Grace Wan. We're discussing the legacy of Mayor George Moscone with Lincoln Mitchell. He's the author of a new book, 3 Years Our Mayor. It's about George Moscone's tenure in San Francisco. And we'd love to hear from you. What questions do you have about George Moscone? And, you know, do you think San Francisco is still a progressive city? You can join us by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Francis writes, I remember this time in San Francisco between this murder and Dan White murdering Harvey Milk and George Moscone. Late November 1978 was a dark time. And George wrote, writes, I grew up in the Bay Area and often worked in San Francisco. A few months earlier, I had met George Moscone at a public event. When the assassinations happened, initially it was feared that it was a reaction to the Jonestown massacre, which had happened only about a week before. Lincoln, I wanted to pick that up, George's comment about kind of the vibe in San Francisco at the time Moscone was murdered. I mean, you had a lot of disruption during the 70s, and Jonestown and the People's Temple was a really thorny issue. Remind our listeners what that was about.
I will. I would also say that I did write a book in 2019 called San Francisco Year Zero, Political Upheaval, Punk Rock, and a Third Place Baseball Team. Which is about that year, 1978. So I recommend it.
Okay. Yes. All right.
I wove the Giants and punk rock into that. But, you know, the People's Temple, we all know the last chapter, right? We all know essentially they go to Guyana, to decamp to Guyana. Most of the members go. Mm. Importantly, from a very specific side, it was not Kool-Aid. The phrase drink the Kool-Aid is deceptive. It was Flavor-Aid. And it was not a mass suicide. It was a mass murder. But Jim Jones had been involved in progressive politics in San Francisco since the early 1970s and in California since before that. And he was, you know, from a kind of civil rights and economic perspective, a progressive going back to the 50s in Indianapolis. And this is what makes it so complicated, because he also was a brutal, abusive, eventually murderous on a colossal scale, megalomaniacal cult leader. But he built political relationships. And the complexity was that he supported George Moscone in what was a very, very close runoff election in 75 between Moscone and Barbara Gelati. He supported him in the first round also. As soon as the killings in Jonestown happened, this story began to emerge that he had stolen the election, or actually it started earlier, for George Moscone. I've worked on election fraud related issues in dozens of countries in my other kind of professional life. And I really studied this. I don't think that's true. I think that Jones clearly helped Moscone, but he didn't steal the election for him. On the other hand, as late as the fall of 78, when there is growing concern about Jim Jones and about what's happening down in Guyana, people are trying to get news out to their family. You know, things aren't so good here. Moscone was supporting him. So it was a complex relationship. Moscone appointed him chair of the Housing Commission, but also kind of distanced himself from him. Jones was disappointed. He wanted a higher level job. And I saw letters when I was doing research that Jones wrote saying, you know, appoint this person, this person, this person, and Moscone didn't do it.
Interesting. I mean, so Moscone, for better or worse, did have the support of kind of this cult leader.
Absolutely. And so did a lot of other politicians. I mean, it was not that uncommon. On the other hand, and we should also remember that many of the members of the of People's Temple were African-American. So it was specifically important in the African-American community, you know, the neighborhoods of what was the Western Addition Fillmore and kind of Bayview Hunters Point. But to say that Jones delivered those neighborhoods is nonsense. Mm. You know, Moscone had such a strong record and backing of so many of the African-American leaders. Jones was white, by the way, not least of whom was Willie Brown, who really worked hard in that election and without whom I don't think Moscone wins.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wanted to talk about that coalition because, you know, again, San Francisco is a small town. It does feel like I wouldn't say that they're machines, but because it's a small town, it's a big city, small city, you know, getting ahead politically, what do they call it, like a knife fight in a phone booth, you know, is a little bit of what San Francisco politics are like. So Moscone built this new kind of coalition of voters that was ahead of his time. And was that by sheer personality or the help of the Burtons and Willie Brown, or what? Or was it the fact that he was running against somebody who was a little bit more establishment and had the downtown vote, Barbara Gelati? So Moscone had no choice but to come up with a coalition.
I might start by saying that I've spent a lot of time working and observing politics in both New York and San Francisco. And I have to say, I was deeply, very involved with and watching closely the last mayor's race in San Francisco, and I'm watching this one here in New York. Compared to New York, San Francisco is a pillow fight in a phone booth. I mean, it's nothing like New York. So I've always kind of, I think there's a certain lack of comparative perspective there, because San Francisco politics is competitive, but it's not I mean, you don't hear the word pogrom thrown around San Francisco politics the way you do here, for example, right?
Wow. Yeah, this is why we don't live in New York, Lincoln.
Well,
this is why we're here.
Hey, if anyone from any of the major universities in the Bay Area is listening and they want to talk, they know where to reach me.
Uh-huh.
I'm joking, but I'm not really. But the coalition, you know, remember Feinstein in that election was the centrist candidate. She was kind of the Daniel Lurie, the darling of the wealthy classes, the kind of most presentable, you know, the most comfortable with downtown, liberal on social issues, but, you know, people they could work with. Barbara Gelada was an angry backlash conservative. And what Barbara Gelada did, John Barbara Gelada, that was so smart, is that he knew that if he got in a runoff with Feinstein, Feinstein would beat him. And he knew that the only way he had a chance of winning was to knock Feinstein out. So he just went after Feinstein really nastily. Mm. When he gets in the race, he refers to her as a housewife.
Yes.
Dianne Feinstein at that time was the president of the Board of Supervisors, right? And a very accomplished politician. But to him, because she was a woman, she was a housewife.
Yeah.
That's the kind of political guy he was. The election was very close, really competing visions for the future of San Francisco. Moscone with a pluralist, economically very progressive vision, and John Barbara Gelada, you know, with a kind of Frank Rizzo, proto Rudy Giuliani, before he really went off the rails, type of candidacy. But ultimately, you know, we don't know what would have happened because Moscone was assassinated, you know, at the end of his third year in office. But what we saw is that in the almost 45 years since he was, more than 45 years since he was killed, the only person who's reassembled that coalition was Art Agnos. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but that kind of the African-American population is smaller. It's no longer the linchpin of the progressive population, uniquely in of the coalition in San Francisco compared to other cities. The gay population is very big still, but it's not because LGBT equality is broadly viewed as kind of the price of admission into San Francisco politics. No one faction can capture that. And of course, all the demographic changes. But I think that there was a moment in the 80s when that coalition could have been kept together. The next progressive coalition in San Francisco has to look a little different.
Hmm. And what because of the demographic shifts?
The demographic shifts, the economic shifts, there's a whole lot. And also, you know, I mean, in 2024, we had a mayor's election where in a city, and I know that not everyone likes to hear this, but in a city where crime was quite low, it dominated the conversation, right? In a city where housing and homelessness are major issues, It dominated the conversation as if it never existed in other cities. The two biggest issues facing San Francisco from a governance perspective are climate change and wealth inequality. And to me, those are the kinds of things that should be at the center of a progressive coalition and a progressive approach to governing the city. Mm. And, you know, Moscone wasn't around at a time when people talked a lot about climate change. But wealth inequality was a kind of central to his vision he saw it as a central problem, which is why he mobilized the neighborhoods against downtown.
Yeah, and I was going to say that because talk about that next, because, you know, this idea of the West Side or the South Side versus, you know, the financial district, I mean, which today barely exists given, COVID and stuff. I mean, Moscone really was a proponent of giving neighborhoods the right to make their own choices. And, you know, interestingly, like the Great Highway debate, you know, it's now a park and most of the people who don't live near the park are near the Great Highway are the ones who voted in favor of it. And everybody close to that stretch of road voted against it. I mean, that's kind of neighborhood politics at play here in San Francisco.
Right. Neighborhood politics are complicated because they don't fit in easily into left and right categories. One example I talk about in the book, which I think is very, very relevant for San Francisco today, is the freeway revolts. In the 1950s and 1960s, the mayor, it was George Christopher, later Jack Shelley, and later Joe Alioto, the governor, usually Pat Brown, but also Reagan when he came in, and the board Chamber of Commerce and the federal government for a while, wanted to essentially destroy San Francisco with a network of freeways. And the neighborhoods, the conservative West Side neighborhoods, the more progressive, you know, Eastern neighborhoods, low income, high income, black, white, Latino, Asian, everything, all the neighborhood groups, and you go to the San Francisco Library and read these letters, mobilized against it. And the smart politicians like the Burtons, Willie Brown, and George Moscone were instrumental in defeating those freeways, which saved San Francisco. Had those freeways been built, San Francisco, as we know, would be destroyed. be destroyed. There would be no neighborhoods. But that, I don't know that that really is a left-right issue. And we certainly see that today around some of the upzoning, which is, I think, the 21st century version of that, in that it sees San Francisco's purpose as making it easier for wealthy people, largely from out of town, to use the city rather than for people who live there and are working there to make it affordable for them. So these issues are complicated. The other thing that's central here is that in Moscone's day, the neighborhoods were mobilized against downtown financial interests. Again, downtown in the literal sense of downtown, but major corporations and banks and law firms and all that kind of thing. Today, San Francisco is still a relatively small city, but there's global wealth there. So it's even more difficult. I mean, we had a race for the Board of Supervisors where the richest man in the world, who didn't even live in San Francisco anymore, here I'm talking about that great Democrat Elon Musk, got involved in defeating one of a sitting member of the Board of Supervisors. So that's an amount of money that no neighborhood progressive can keep up with.
Well, also, when you think about the neighborhoods, I mean, with houses, even in the avenues or Excelsior, I mean, going for millions of dollars, it doesn't really feel working class anymore. Feels like there's legacy of working class families out there, but people moving in are not, you know, don't feel like typical working class families.
No, I don't think it's been I don't think it is a working class city anymore. And that and it may be aspirational, right? I think we all would want to make it more livable and affordable for working people. But we have to recognize that this is not the 1950s and it's not the city in which George Moscone grew up, right? Which was essentially very strong pro-labor, voted in huge numbers for the Democratic Party, reasonably socially conservative, right? It's a city that's changed. And even the coalition that elected Moscone, I mean, there's no exit poll data from that election in 75, but I went through, I mean, there's maps in the book, and I went through looking at precinct level data. And he was elected, the neighborhoods where he cleaned up were Bayview, Hunters Point, the Western edition of the Fillmore, huge African-American vote, the Castro. And then the other neighborhoods he does well are places like the Haight, right, which are newer San Franciscans, which aren't really necessarily working class. Where he gets his clock cleaned was in the working class areas of the Sunset and the Richmond, even though he was living out there, because by the time he was, well, it wasn't quite, but he eventually moved to St. Francis Wood for the last few years of his life once he became mayor. So the working class San Francisco was not as instrumental in the Moscone coalition as the storyline might tell you. And I think that's been true of progressive politics in major cities for some time.
Is that because you think progressive policies and politicians kind of catered towards an elite?
I think it's the same reason, particularly back then, that, you know, people like, well, this is the 70s we're talking about, people like Richard Nixon were winning elections for president. It was a backlash issue. And Moscone's, you know, Moscone had always had huge union support, and that helped him be competitive in those areas. Mm-hmm. But he was seen as, and to go back to your initial question, you know, I talked to somebody recently who's a little bit younger than Moscone, but who went to St. Ignatius and became a very progressive politician. And he said the things that he was seen as betraying his class almost as a white ethnic guy from the West Side who became a progressive. So the appeals then, it was very much about backlash. You know, Moscone was seen as a pro-gay because he was. He was seen as, you know, a friend of the black people because he was. And a lot of white working class folks weren't enamored to that. And it's, you know, a lot of rich white folks weren't enamored to him because he wanted to, you know, redistribute some of the money. But it's, you know, these are the same struggles we talk about at the national level today and have been for some time.
Yeah. So, you know, when you think about Moscone, you know, you wrote this book about him. What do you think his legacy is today then? I mean, is it the bringing power to the neighborhoods, having district supervisors versus, you know, supervisors elected by the entire city? What's the through line from Moscone back then to Daniel Lurie today?
Well, I think a big part of his legacy is in the state legislature, where I think he really charted the course for progressive California, passing laws. I mentioned decriminalizing sex between two consenting adults, decriminalizing acupuncture, which was a big deal in terms of thinking of California.
I love it. I mean, as a fan of acupuncture, that is awesome.
I decriminalizing having small amounts of marijuana issue with you. As a mayor, I think the two biggest parts of his legacy, and this sounds like a small thing, but I don't think it's a small thing, The day he was inaugurated as mayor of San Francisco, there was a headline in the papers of Toronto, which, of course, in a different country, on a different coast, a different part of the world, I mean, you know, different part of North America, saying, we have a major league team because the Giants were going to Toronto. That was, he was hit with that his first day in office. And he spent the first 3 months, took a lot of his time to ensure that the Giants would stay in San Francisco. So if, like me, you're really happy that those three World Series flags are flying at the ballpark and you like that new ballpark and like having a big league team, wouldn't be true without George Moscone.
Well, I mean, you know, Oakland could have used him. Oakland could have used that kind of help a couple of years ago.
Well, I think once Bob Lurie bought the team, he was working with ownership that was a little bit more honest and fair-minded than the current A's ownership. I also think diversifying city government. Mm-hmm. After George Moscone, the city was never run by just old white guys, straight white guys from downtown. So that's a huge thing, too. The Moscone Center, which he really pushed through and was a very controversial at the time, but he made it happen. Mm-hmm. But I think it's articulating a vision of what neighborhood politics can look like, what progressive politics can look like, the through line from Moscone to Lurie. I don't want to try to pretend that there's something there that it isn't, right? I mean, Lurie went to town school and university high school. This is not a working class guy from what was then a working class neighborhood. You know, Lurie comes from tremendous wealth, the exact opposite of Moscone. And Moscone was a career politician. By the time he became mayor, he was a real insider. This was his life, and that's, for better or for worse, not true of Lurie. And I think Lurie is much more comfortable, not just in the halls of power, because Moscone was comfortable in every corner of the city, but around real money in a way that Moscone never saw that as his people. He could use them. He's wanted money sometimes, but it wasn't of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly a lot to unpack in your book. And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us, Lincoln. It was a pleasure to have you.
It was a pleasure to be on. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Lincoln Stevens is the author of 3 Years Our Mayor. Lincoln Mitchell is the author of 3 Years Our Mayor, George Moscone and the Making of Modern San Francisco. Coming up after the break, we'll learn about the mysteries of the Sutro Library. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is One Way Possible, your sonic scavenger. It's Monday, and tonight I will be with you from 8 to 10 p.m. So join me and catch a vibe right here on KALW 91.7 FM and KALW.org.
Join KLW tomorrow night for a live and free comedy show in downtown San Francisco. It's Pride, Protest, and Punchlines, riotous comedy, radical joy, and food from our sponsor, Joyride Pizza. It's all happening tomorrow night. Doors at 6 p.m., comedy at 7 at KLW's studio event space at 220 Montgomery Street in downtown San Francisco. Find more information at kalw.org.
Self-professed history geeks, like me, love to look at original historic documents, and recently I've been involved in a play called The Book of Will, which is about one of those historic documents. It is the story of how the first printed one-volume book of all of William Shakespeare's plays came to life, and it's called The First Folio, and I needed to research that for my role. Now, the interweb, as I affectionately call it, pulled up locations of first folios all around the world, so imagine my surprise when the web told me I could find a first folio up close and personal right here in San Francisco at the Sutro Library. Shakespeare's folio is part of a much larger collection held by Adolph Sutro, which at the time of his death included over 300,000 books and papers from the 13th to the 19th centuries. And here to tell us about this amazing resource is the Sutro Library's director, Maddie Terramina. Maddie, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you, Fred. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, having been at the Sutro Library and geeked out, I'm excited to talk about it. So let's start at the very beginning. Who was Adolph Sutro?
It's a great question. Adolph Sutro was born in Aachen, Prussia, which is now Germany, and he came to the United States in 1850. He did settle in San Francisco, and he eventually makes his fortune as an engineer in mining. He's best known for creating the Sutro Tunnel, which is this massive drainage tunnel project there in Nevada that was designed to drain the water of the Comstock Lode, which were the mines there in Virginia City. And after he becomes very wealthy, he comes back to San Francisco and starts to invest in land and infrastructure. He developed Sutro Heights, which we're all familiar with. He also developed Sutro Baths. There was also a Sutro Railway line that would take you to the baths. He opened up areas like Land's End, Mount Sutro. He was very philanthropic, and he was a one-time mayor of San Francisco.
That's wild. So tell us about the library itself. I mean, how did this collection come about?
Sure. The Sutro Library is actually part of the California State Library, and it belongs to the people of California. Adolph Sutro collected books his entire life, and he collected books all the way till the day he died in 1898. But obviously, you can imagine, as he's an engineer, he gets very busy. So what he does is he hires people to go all around the world and buy books for him and ship them in crates to San Francisco. These books were then stored in those crates in two warehouses downtown San Francisco. Mm-hmm. And he just kept telling the press and the newspaper that he was going to donate his beautiful private library to the people of San Francisco so that anyone, regardless of academic credentials, regardless of your background, could come in and learn from a world-class library, just like they had at Harvard, just like they have here at the UC systems. So he basically amassed this library for the people.
Wow. Let's talk about some of the things in the collection. Now, I mentioned the folio in the beginning. Can you give a little bit more detail about the first folio, what it is, how important it is?
Sure. The first folio is a remarkable, remarkable book. It's the very first time that William Shakespeare's works were all collected into one written book. It sounds kind of obvious to us, but at that time, when you're doing a play, everybody gets a part, and we know that, but that literally does mean you are getting only the printed part that you are supposed to be responsible for. You're not getting the entire play at once. So after William Shakespeare dies, and John Hemmings and Henry Condell, these are two fellow actors of his, they're partners with Shakespeare, they pulled all the parts together and published for the first time 18 plays that had never been published, for the first time ever published and put in one work, one book. It was incredible. And that this one copy, the first folio, is how we even know Shakespeare's works to begin with. The Sutro contains the first folio, but we actually also hold the second, third, and fourth folios as well.
Right.
So every iteration of the first folio, which is the second folio, the third, the fourth, contains materials that were left out before. I mean, basically, the only reason why we know that this man exists is because of this book.
Let's talk about some other things in the collection. What are your other prized collections you have at the Sutro Library?
Well, you're asking a librarian, so everything is prized.
I know I am.
Everything is loved. We love everything. But okay. I would say some of the things that we are very well known for and topics that are very strong in our library. First thing that comes to mind is the Tata Loco collection. And this is a collection of rare books that were brought actually and were part of the first academic library in the Western Hemisphere. So Spain establishes the Colegio de Santa Cruz in 1536 as a way of educating the ruling class of Aztecs. Sutro acquired this collection in 1889 when he purchased the oldest bookstore and printing house in Mexico City. So this is an incredible strength for us. People come from all around the world to use the Tata Loco collection. Another strength we have are the English pamphlets. I know it doesn't sound exciting, but pamphlets were the social media of their time. They're quick, they're persuasive, and they were everywhere. Our collection has 11,000 English pamphlets from the 1500s to the 1800s, making it the richest collection on the West Coast. So you'll find fiery theological debates, political treaties, biographies, and my favorite are the parliamentary proceedings on issues such as the American Revolution. And the authors are real big names. We're talking Burke, Hogarth, Francis Drake, Walter Riley, William Pitt, Samuel Johnson, to name a few.
Well, I know what I'm looking for the next time I come back to the library, which will be soon. What can you tell us about the incunabula?
Yes. So Adolf Sutro reportedly had one out of every six incunabula on Earth was in his hands. And incunabula, or cradle books, are the very first books ever printed in the Western world using movable type.
Wow.
So these are books that date from 1455 to about 1501. And I realize that that sounds like, well, they're printed. Isn't every book at that time then the same? But it really wasn't. This is when printers were learning the craft. So it actually means even though they were using technology to make the work, each incunabula, meaning each book, each copy of Dante's Inferno, for example, is actually not going to be the same.
You also have a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation. Is that correct?
We have a pocket Emancipation Proclamation, and there's only 10 that remain out of over a million that were published. This is a very rare copy that was created by John Murray Forbes, and he was a lawyer, and he felt very passionate that when Abraham Lincoln released the Emancipation Proclamation, that people that were enslaved, how will they get that news? Who will tell them this? How will they know? So he had over a million copies made of very thin, very small pocket editions of the Emancipation Proclamation, and Union soldiers were supposed to hand it to the formerly enslaved and tell them they were free. Mm. Honestly, that's how many found out that they were finally free. So this little tiny pocket emancipation, it's, you're talking personal, person-to-person democracy. It's the most transformative thing to hold this object and think that this is how people got their rights.
Now, I understand the library also continues to collect.
Yes, we do collect. And in fact, the largest collection that we've just added is the 2017 Women's March posters. These are the posters that happened on January 21st in 2017. And they're the marches that occurred here in the state of California, not necessarily Washington, D.C. But they are 288 physical posters that we've collected, which include pussy hats, sashes, pinback buttons, and testimonials, photographs, media coverage, and then, of course, the actual posters themselves.
Well, I'm afraid we've run out of time tonight. There's so much information we could ask you about, but I'd like to tell the audience, if you'd like to leaf through our Shakespeare folio or see the pocket Emancipation Proclamation we discussed, or maybe read some medieval text, you can make an appointment. You go to www.library.ca.gov/sutro/, and you can make an appointment to see this collection. I can tell you from experience, it's very easy. Maddie, I would like to thank you for being on our show tonight. We appreciate your time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. And I'm so excited that you found our library to be worthy of this talk. It's wonderful.
And hopefully others will come.
Yes.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We hope you'll join us next Monday at 6 when KALW's own Rose Aguilar talks about her new podcast on the challenges of caregiving. And remember to subscribe to the State of the Bay podcast wherever you listen so you never miss an episode. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, you can visit our page on the KALW website. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. We're at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb and Heather Hughes. Fred Pitts was my fellow host, and the show was engineered by Devin Strolovich, and D Minor was our board operator. A rebroadcast of today's Your Call is next. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.